The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmn.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from the Transmission of Light, page 30. Hueka studied with the Buddhist master Bodhidharma. One day he said to Bodhidharma, "I've already ended all involvements." Bodhidharma said, "Doesn't that turn into nihilism?" Hueka said, "No." Bodhidharma said, "How can you prove it?" Hueka said, "I'm always clearly aware. Therefore, words cannot reach it." Bodhidharma said, "This is the essence of the mind, which all Buddhas realize. Doubt no more." Kazon's verse. Empty, yet radiantly bright, conditioned thought ended. Perspicuous, aware, always open and clear. So we're concluding an introductory retreat this morning that some of you have been joining us and have been here for. And I was preparing this, I thought this is the kind of language that, you know, frightens people, ending all involvements, or maybe frightens even more your family and friends, that you're going to come home with a shaved head or monk's robes, or maybe not come home at all. These ideas that travel around about Buddhist teachings, Buddhist practice, what is non-attachment, what is selflessness, what is ending all involvements. Hueka was, this is very early in the Zen tradition, Bodhidharma's is considered the beginning of the Zen tradition in China. He was an Indian master who came to China, and one of his disciples was Hueka. So this is very early, 6th century, 500s. And he came to Bodhidharma saying that his mind was not at peace. And he begged Bodhidharma to help him set his mind at peace. And Buddhism faces this very, very directly. I remember when I first started reading about the Dharma in my teens, and you know, there's very little to read at that point, but reading and this language that was so plain and direct about these aspects of our lives, that we get old and we get sick and we die, and that there's suffering. And it didn't just immediately follow it up with, you know, "Don't worry, we'll take care of it." And there was something about that that was very compelling. It was very affirming. Because there was a path. There is a path. There's a teaching and a practice of the Four Reminders that is a practice of contemplating what it is to have a precious human life. Not just because we're alive, but because of what we do with our lives and how our lives can become something very important, valuable. Not in a big ego kind of sense, but in terms of what we're able to offer the world. And so sitting within that awareness and feeling the gratitude and appreciation for having this life, then we turn our attention to the contemplation of impermanence and death, which just accentuates, I think, that sense of preciousness, because we realize it's fleeting, right? What makes spring so exquisite is that it doesn't last forever. And so we shouldn't miss it. And then we turn our attention to the dissatisfying nature of samsara, to just contemplate our own experience of samsara and the display of samsara, the cycle, the endless cycle of grasping and obtaining, of losing, of disappointment, and of self-centeredness, and conflict. And that despite all of our best efforts, having learned, sort of taken in all the messages we've received from our culture and all the ideas about how to manage all of that, and realizing, well, I've tried, I really have, and it's just not enough. Huica says, I've ended all of my involvement. So what are our entanglements? The Buddha said that our deluded mind can be like a knot. And like a knot, the more you pull on that, Huica here is talking about the involvements that bring our pain and sorrow, our insecurity, our doubt. What are they? What are those entanglements? We live within relationships to people and our work, our possessions, the physical things we surround ourselves with, our desires, the earth, even if we never give it a thought. The earth never goes on vacation, have you noticed? It never takes a day off from supplying us with everything we need. And yet we can spend our whole lives and never think about it. We live within our relationships of our suffering and our mind, thoughts and emotions, sensations, energies. And the Buddha says about all of that, that everything that gathers together will disperse. Everything that rises will fall. Everything that has life will lose that life, will die. And everything that meets will part. Bodhidharma said, when people are alive, we worry about death. When we're full, we worry about hunger. This is the great uncertainty. Enlightened beings don't dwell in the past, don't worry about the future, and don't cling to the present. Moment to moment, they follow the way. I came across this, it's given a book by poetry by Christian Wiman. And the first poem, I thought, spoke to this. To eat the awful while you starve your awe. To weasel misery like a suck of egg. To be ebulliences prick and leak, a character pinched to characteristic, hell relisher, persimmon sipper, sad Tom, sane Tom, all day licking these cicatrix where your Tomhood lay. A cicatrix is a wound that is healing, like the wound on a tree that heals, but there's a scar that remains. To eat the awful while we starve our awe. I thought maybe that's a sort of a very beautiful and terrible and direct way of describing the state of our spiritual health. That we consume so much while we're starving our awe. And we can't go without that, I think. Awe, that is. And so when we're not finding it in genuine places, we'll try and find it in places that are not actually genuine. They create a kind of facsimile, a sort of a sad Tom replacement of our awe. And yet, Tom is very sane. He's doing what he's supposed to do. He's been doing what he's been told to do. He's following the plan. When there is no peace, where is the place that peace does not reside? Where did it go? Buddhism teaches so much about how easy it is to look outside of ourselves, to find the fault. And you can always find something to point to. There are so many things that should not be, that should be otherwise, and this has always been true. And so we can occupy ourselves full time with all of those things that should not be but are, and much of the time be correct. And so the Bodhisattva does apply themselves to alleviating suffering, to bringing benefit in the world. And so in ordinary life in samsara, perhaps at best we apply ourselves to making the world a better place to live based on the old plan or some version of it. Or as we sort of move along the spectrum, we think our life is just to satisfy our desires and whatever room's left over to be concerned for others. Or as we move further along, to just go about getting whatever we want and everybody else is left to themselves in our mind. Where do we place ourselves? Where do we place others? The Buddha realized that the belief in a separate, independent, eternal self is the pivot point, is sort of the crux of the matter. And so we sit, we study, we examine this mind, all the different ways that this sense of self arises and our investment in it, how real it becomes in our mind. And even if we work so hard in our life to accomplish and gather in as much of the good that we can, and there is so much good to gather in, still there can be a deep inner not yet at peace. And so in our zazen, we practice very directly letting go of our inner and outer involvements. And so when we go to the cushion, we make a very clear awareness, bring an awareness that this is the time not to spend the day planning the rest of the day, spend our time in zazen planning the rest of the day or working out our problems. Those things may very much need our attention. And we should give them our attention at another time and place. Because if we do it in zazen, we're training ourselves to use that time for that purpose, which may be beneficial towards addressing those matters, but it will not help us get to the heart of the thing. And in our culture, to sit and stop and not produce something within a culture which is somewhat manic and is sort of a factory for breeding, never enough, never enough. No matter what. That to stop and sit in your own sufficiency, your own completeness, is kind of heretical and can be perceived by the practitioner or by others who are observing as callous, as isolating, as cut off. And so we need to make sure that that's not what we're doing. Practice itself is a path that is about attaining the way, accomplishing the way, realizing self-nature. And so how we practice will inevitably bring in elements of that sort of acquisitional way of seeing things. So we were going to get enlightenment and we're going to get rid of our delusion. And we practice that way until that gets corrected, until that view becomes unhelpful, which is actually pretty much right at the beginning, but we don't really notice it. It can take a while. And so being endowed with Buddha nature, with that complete, sufficient, joyful, peaceful nature, we need to strive to not seek a happier version of an isolated self. When we think of self-improvement, it's sort of like we just want a happier version of a self that is still distant and separate. So Hueka says, I have already ended all my involvements. when he came to Bodhidharma and said, my mind is not at peace, Bodhidharma said, bring your mind to me. Bring that mind that is not at peace to me, and I'll set it at rest for you. And Huayca did that. He searched and he searched. He had deep faith in his teacher. And he came back after some period of time. It might have been days, it might have been weeks or longer. And he said, finally, I cannot find this mind. And Bodhidharma said, now it is at rest. In the commentary, it says, outwardly, cease all involvements. Inwardly, have no coughing or sighing in the mind. With your mind like a wall, you can enter the way. Oftentimes, we speak of walls as walls that divide. No hindrance in the mind can be translated as no walls in the mind. Those walls that separate keep us trapped in and keep the world trapped out. But this wall that he's speaking of is a wall that is stable and tranquil and is awake, a wall like a mountain. And so we sit facing this wall, our mind, in Zazen, facing the wall which is a mirror, facing the self. And we practice seeing clearly our involvements, which we speak of as our karma, the results of all of these past action. In Buddhism, that's understood as going back an infinite number of lifetimes, which is why, so perhaps why it's, if we think of it that way or have faith in it that way, it's so hard to sometimes piece together why, how this is arising. Where did this come from? And so we practice very deliberately, as those involvements arise, to not get involved. They arise because of past actions, past involvements, past. It's this present arising is the result of a past knot. K-N-O-T. And the practice is to not create another one. The Buddha said that first arising, which can be painful, is like being shot with an arrow. When we grab onto it, when we deny it and suppress it and say, no, no, this cannot be. Or when we grab onto it and say, yes, this must be, then we're shooting a second arrow. And that's the arrow that is the seat of both the perpetuation of our suffering, but it's also that place of pivot, where it stops. And so in the faith mind, it says, the great way is not difficult, just have no preferences. In the moment of love or hate or sour or sweet or past or future, the moment that it arises, have no preference. Don't love it. Don't hate it. If you wish to see the truth, just in that moment, hold no opinion for or against. Don't create a wall that separates and divides. Don't ask, are you with me or against me? To set up what you like against what you dislike is the dis-ease of the mind. All of these teachings that are pointing to the moment those involvements arise. But then Bodhidharma asks, importantly, doesn't this turn into nihilism? And the Buddha taught a great deal about this, and there's all throughout the teachings of Buddhism, the middle path. So one of the essential ways in which that's presented is the middle path between nihilism. Nothing exists, nothing matters, there is no causation. Everything is empty. The other side being what the Buddha called eternalism, where everything is just as it appears. It exists in its own state, independent, separate, self-existing, autonomous. And the Buddha said both of those will necessarily lead to suffering because it's built into it. It's built into the system. It's built into the view. You know, if we think about why the Buddha left home, which was a place in terms of how his own words, his own depiction of his own life prior to leaving home, it was a place of wealth, it was a place of position and status, abundance. He described himself as being spoiled. He had different homes for different seasons, right? He had the life that, you know, most people want. Wealth, security, position, family. Why did he leave? Because he realized it wasn't secure, actually. And because it wasn't secure, it was a place of anxiety. That wealth was not, in a sense, a true wealth. It was precarious. It came, it went. It comes, it goes. It has to be defended. Wars will be fought, small and large. Because none of that security or position or status or any of the good stuff was going to last. It was all impermanent. He knew that. He was not at peace. But why did he live? Why did he leave? Because he wanted to live. So in a sense, he wasn't leaving something so much as trying to move towards something. He wasn't abandoning so much as he was trying to find the place where that true life that we sense, that we seek, that we yearn for, is actually taking place. So Dharma practice is not and has never been a negation of life. Now, sometimes the teachings and the way the teachings are presented can seem to say the contrary. And one of the aspects of the teachings is they're very condensed. Oftentimes, they're very succinct, right? They present these profound truths in the fewest words possible, with the assumption that those will be expounded for you by a teacher. But when we don't do that, right, when that doesn't happen, we can walk away thinking, having very different and misguided understanding about what the Buddhism is teaching. So it's not a negation of life. It's exactly the opposite. It's affirmation, but not based on grasping, aversion, fragile moments of truce. But nor is it a fantasized view of life. Life is dukkha. There is suffering. Everything is impermanent. There is sickness, old age, death, and death. If we do not face those truths, then we spend our life consciously or unconsciously knowing we are not facing something that is essential. And how can that not create anxiety? And so we either face that and skillfully, with a path, use that, use those truths to free ourselves, or we just have to get more and more busy. Turn up the volume. I was watching, and I really have no idea what I'm talking about. I'll just say that flat out from the beginning. So you can disregard everything that I say in the next couple of minutes, or actually at any time. But I was watching the presentation by Zuckerberg about the new Facebook Meta universe. And as best as I could understand it, the possibility, or maybe the present existence of this virtual world, wonderful, incredible, amazing virtual world that's being provided and is going to be brought to us, and it's just going to be wonderful. And I thought of eating something awful or fascinating, exciting, stimulating, while we starve our awe. and place that somewhere else. In the Lankavatara Sutra, it says it's better to have a large sense of self than attachment to a nihilistic view. It's a very strong statement in a practice that is based in realizing selflessness and that's the heart of our suffering. What I see in that teaching is that the danger that can come from these two views, one of being embedded in the sense of self and one of denying that and everything, that is much more dangerous. And don't we see that? When we retreat into nothing matters. You know, Elizabeth Mantas Namgyel, who taught on Thursday evening, a Tibetan Buddhist teacher, she was talking about the middle path, the Madhyamaka school, and she said, in the middle way, nothing is neutral or extreme, we could say. Nothing is neutral about this path that we're on. It's awake, it's alert, and then she said, can we bear that much life? And at first glance, we might think, of course, that's what I want. That's why I'm here. That's what I'm seeking. Consider it closely. Just observe. Just observe what happens when we get closer. It happens all the time in Zazen. When you get closer to actually being at rest, you know, we come in with an acquired, a learned restlessness in our body. It's just all over. Right? And when that begins to settle, when the mind begins to relax, when the stillness, we begin to return to that, reclaim that, which is rightfully ours and is never anywhere else. Our own silence, how very frequently the reaction is unbearable. I cannot bear this. And so we turn away. We turn away into thought. We turn away into distraction. I've talked to people who are practicing at home who don't really understand what's happening, and they're just reporting, and they got so frightened that they just got up and walked away and stopped sitting. Can we bear that much life? Can we bear to actually free ourselves of those, that knot of involvements? And so Kazan says, that which we are reclaiming, practicing, cultivating, realizing, is empty. Empty of any fixed characteristic. Empty of any independent existence. It is not outside. It cannot be given. It can never be lost. And it is radiantly bright. Conditioned thought ended. Conditioned thought means thoughts that arise as a result of the production based on that paradigm of you and me, of win or lose, of peace and war, of gain and of loss and success. Conditioned thought ended. Now, we can give rise to thought that is unbound, is liberated. Huai Nung said, do not bind your thoughts. He didn't say, stop thinking. He didn't say, there's something wrong with your thoughts. He said, when we stop binding them, putting them into bondage, then we'll see that they do not obstruct. Perspicuous, aware, always open and clear. I had to look up again, perspicuous. I guess I don't use that word enough. Easily understood, clearly expressed. What a great word. That's our mind, naturally. That the less cluttered, the less cloudy, the more radiant and bright and empty of all that we project into and onto, then we can see and understand And so teachers say, when you raise up one corner, you see underneath the other three. That we see, when we see into a tangled knot of humanity, that we're able to see more clearly what's really happening. I remember years ago, I was really struggling. You know, there's an old saying in monasteries, I think it's fairly universal, that there's always someone here who's been specially invited to be here while you're here to make you crazy, to irritate you, to annoy you, to get under your skin, so that we can cultivate our compassion, develop our patience. And there was one such person. And the thing is, when they leave, someone will replace them, just so you know. So there was this one person for me, and who was had a lot of energy and directed a lot of that towards me. And I was struggled to meet this person. And I was talking to my teacher, and she had a lot of anger. And that was a lot of how she presented herself to me. And I was talking to my teacher, and he says, "You're just getting drawn in to what's on the surface." He said, "Because she's angry, you're just getting stuck on the, in the appearance of that anger." He said, "Look further. See her." He said, "She and each of us is in pain, and that pain comes out in different ways. If she exhibited her pain by quietly weeping," he said, "you probably go over and ask, you know, what, how can I help?" That was helpful. Bodhidharma said, "To see form but not be corrupted by form, to hear sounds but not be deceived by sounds, this is liberation. Then your mind, the mind of your eyes and ears, without clinging, become gateways. To let go really is just to not grasp. The action, if you will, is just to release what's already happening. Letting go is like not like really a new thing. It's addressing the already thing, the grasping. When we return our awareness to the breath, to the moment, all we're really doing is recognizing that it never went away. Bodhidharma said, if you seek the way, let go of clinging to the body as yourself. It's like stripping bark from a tree. This karmic body undergoes constant change. It has no fixed reality. Practice according to your thoughts. That means practice skillfully in the presence of your thoughts. It doesn't mean be dictated by them. It means practice in accord with how your thoughts arise. And that's why the skillfulness is important, because, and thought here, just let that include everything that arises. Because although everything has the same nature, everything is empty and radiantly bright, we don't perceive it that way. That's our karma. The fact that one thought arises or one emotion arises that we are drawn to and say, yes, and another emotion arises that we say, no. And that yes and no take up or take over our whole body, while meanwhile the nature of those emotions is exactly the same. Empty and radiantly bright. It's our karma that doesn't allow us to see that. And so he says, practice according to your thoughts. Don't hate life and death. And don't fearfully cling to life and death. Dogen says, don't cherish what's close at hand and reject what's far away. Don't reject what's close at hand and cherish what's far away. Just make your eyes and ears bright and clear. And all of this helps to open the heart, because we realize all of that grasping at the self creates a sense of wall and division inside and outside that does need to be protected and defended. And so somebody says something and we feel like we are under threat and we respond as though our life is at stake. And from that sort of ego perspective, it is. When that sense of self is who I am, then when you intrude on that, we have a problem. Right? But what happens when we realize that there is actually no boundary? There is no thing that needs to be defended and protected. Compassion arises. Loving kindness arises. In the Prajnaparamita Sutra of 8,000 lines, the Buddha says, the Bodhisattva, filled with compassion and concern for the welfare of beings, brings forth, cultivates their loving kindness, their compassion, their sympathetic joy, their equanimity, the four immeasurables. And they employ that skillfully, with skillful means. He said, it's just like a bird, but they don't dwell in it, he says. They don't dwell in it. They don't attach to it. They don't attach to the fact that all of those very powerful qualities and practices are empty, yet radiantly bright. Being radiantly bright, they have impact. They have consequence. We can use them to benefit ourselves and others. The Bodhisattva just doesn't dwell. Not dwelling, everything that becomes is continually free and available. He says, it's just like a bird who on its wing courses in the air. It neither dwells in space, just in the air, without being supported, or does it settle therein. And so too, a bodhisattva dwells in the dwelling of emptiness, but they don't attach to it. They don't attach to the characteristics and the appearances of things, like an angry face, or a view that I find very difficult, right? Because in that view, I see danger, I see hatred, I see violence. And so how do we meet that in a way that doesn't create more of the same? Because that's the story that's been told over and over and over again, that the liberator becomes the new tyrant. That the answer to the problem becomes the new problem. That the promise becomes the next betrayal. The Buddha said, we have it within each of us to go a new way, a different way, and it's not far away. That's the good thing. And so Bodhidharma says, this is the essence of your mind. This is what every enlightened Buddha realizes. You don't have to doubt anymore. You don't have to travel further. But we do need to practice. Right? The habits are strong. The beliefs are still very present, very alive. But practicing within our own confusion, our struggles, our anger, our despair, having a path, knowing how to turn into your mind, knowing how to sit in the midst of that rather than running away, is so wonderful, isn't it? I remember being in such dark, dark moments where I felt like there was no way through. It just felt intractable. I felt intractable. My mind felt intractable. But then I would remember what it was like before I started practicing, and I would think, no, that was hard. That was hard. This I can do. Because I have a practice. I'll let Christian Wiman have the last word. Always give it to the poets. That's why we need them so much. The more I think, the more I feel reality without reverence is not real. The more I feel, the more I think that God himself has brought me to this brink, wherein to have more faith means having less, and loves the sacred name for loneliness. I speak a word I have not spoken, and by that word am broken open, a cry entirely other, entirely mine. In league with the stones of the field, I am being healed. In such a difficult moment when you are practicing, that's what healing looks like. In a moment of anger, when you practice the anger, that's what compassion looks like. In the company of the stones of the field, I am being healed.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about our ongoing programs and residency opportunities, visit zmm.org.